Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the UBS Market Moves podcast channel, as today we are continuing with our CIO Fixed Income Roundtable series of conversations. Every other month, we do like to touch base with the CIO Fixed Income team for a look at the performance of fixed income subsectors, along with a review of positioning recommendations within. So with that, joining us for today's roundtable conversation, glad to welcome Frank Saleo, Barry McAlinden, Sadiq Mukherjee, as well as Alina Gallant. Leading today's roundtable is Leslie Falconio, the head of taxable fixed income strategy for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. So with that, Leslie, welcome back. I'll pass it over to you to lead today's conversation.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you, everyone, for joining us. I mean, you know, we find even though it's the summer, we really don't have summer doldrums. And what we'd like to just talk about, you know, in this podcast is, you know, really hone in on where we are in the cycle and what's changed sort of the first half of the year. And, you know, and we're very fortunate to have our you know, sector experts on to give their insight and expectation going forward as we, you know, head into the last, you know, 5 months of the year. But I did want to first start with just discussing our recent publication in the fixed income strategist called The Shorter Runway. And the reason why we labeled it that is, as many people know, coming into 2024, once again, the consensus was for many, not from our CIO at UBS, but from, you know, many market participants and particularly what the market was pricing in, that we would once again have a recession in 24. Now, we're always asked why, you know, why are people pricing a recession? And frankly, why aren't we in a recession given the fact that the Fed has been on hold for a year now at a 5.33 effective fund rates? And besides all the fiscal stimulus that we know about, we also are well aware or have come to learn over time is that, you know, usually when the Fed increases interest rates as quickly and to the level that they did, you know, interest rate sensitive sectors such as, like, say, housing or the ability to get, like, auto are impacted, you know, severely, and that has a tendency to slow down the consumer. But as we know, we were faced with two sort of conundrums, if you will, heading in post-COVID. One was the fact that we had increased demand for both housing and autos, right? And the fact that we were dealing with, you know, still dealing with a supply issue, given both in housing and in autos. So that really, you know, those interest rate sensitive sectors really didn't impede the consumer as much as one might think, particularly given that they were locking in a much lower mortgage rate and the fact they had all these excess savings. So where do we stand today? I mean, what we do know and what we do believe is that excess savings that the consumer has is probably dwindled. If not zero, it's close to zero. And we're finally seeing a little bit of turn in the cycle, and this is where the shorter runway comes in, is that we do believe that growth will be lower, inflation will be lower in the second half of the year. And again, I emphasize we expect the economic data to come in weaker that week. We're still looking for the soft landing, but we can't ignore the fact that the unemployment rate is at 4.1%. That's a two-year high. We have ISM now in contractionary standpoint, and although the second quarter GDP has risen from its 1.5% level to about consensus at 2.2. We're still dealing with an inverted yield curve for 2 years, leading indicators that have been negative. And so with that, we are expecting some growth headwinds over the second half. Our interest rate range has been about a 4-4.5 for the past, you know, 8 or 9 weeks, and it's actually worked quite well. And when we think about where we are today, and we reached a 4.14 as of yesterday, you know, the price appreciation that a investor is going to get from fixed income, given our 385-ish outlook, you know, to the end of the year, is not some huge tailwind to total return. Really, the total return is really going to come from the income that you're earning. And that's why it's important that we have the people around today that really deal with those sectors that have to sort of adjust between the risk that you're taking and the income that you're earning. So with that said, I do want to start with Frank Saleo, who heads our preferred and does a lot of great work on the preferred side in terms of, you know, overall recommendation and single security selection. So, Frank, let me start with you in terms of, you know, if you could just give, you know, a kind of review of the first half of the year and how do you position when we think about the shorter runway going forward?
Oh, thanks, Leslie. That was a great intro, and you really set the table well for where we are here at the midpoint of the year. And looking back at the first half, preferreds performed very well in the first half of the year, returning about 5%, pretty decent returns for the first half. But what makes performance notable is that Preferred posted those decent gains despite a somewhat difficult backdrop, as you outlined there. During the first half of the year, nominal Treasury rates rose along the curve, and specifically the 10-year Treasury yield rose to as high as 470 or higher in April from 388 at the start of the year. Now, normally, that would present a major headwind to Preferred, but as I said, the sector gained about 5%. That includes a 3.9% return for $25 par preferred and a 6.1% return for the $1,000 par preferred. Now, one mitigating factor kind of countering the higher interest rate or the higher trending rate backdrop of the first half was likely the technical support of net redemption of preferreds. About $20 billion worth of preferreds were called and redeemed in the first half of the year, and those redemptions generally outpaced new issuance. Another interesting aspect of performance, or an interesting element in the first half, is that those gains all occurred in the first quarter. Preferred started the year on a positive note with a string of monthly gains, but after five consecutive months of gains, the streak was broken in April as the backdrop in rates accelerated. As I mentioned earlier, that's when we really saw the peak in April. Preferreds were down by about 2.4% that month in April. They were up 2% in May, and they had some marginal gains in June. So you see this kind of up and down type of pattern emerging in the second quarter, and so we actually had a flat quarter in the second quarter after gains of about 5% in the first 3 months of the year. So far this month, given the string of supportive economic data in terms of things like the CPI, et cetera, and the decline in rates we've seen in recent weeks, preferreds are actually up by about 1.5% in just the first half of the month. So we're on track for a pretty strong July. But looking ahead into the second half in terms of what we might be expecting in terms of an outlook, we're basically expecting more mild returns from here with continued choppiness in performance similar to what we've seen in the second quarter. We do expect the Fed's first cut, the first rate cut by the Federal Reserve to occur in the second half, notably in September, and that could provide continued support for the sector along with a continued lower trend in rates in general. Supportive technicals in the form of continued redemptions, as I mentioned, that have taken place, are also likely to provide a tailwind. We just got this week another announcement by one of the major bank issuers for another big call. They called one of their large preferred issues. And so those are supportive factors. One limiting factor may be current valuation, which could expose preferred to a pullback, especially if economic slowdown fears emerge and intensify. As you mentioned, Buzzy, we do expect the economy, economic trends to weaken, but not necessarily be weak. It'll be weaker, but not weak. You know, and that could maybe set us up for maybe a temporary pullback if those fears intensify. But overall, I would say, you know, we're looking for a two steps forward, two steps back type of performance pattern in the second half, resulting in generally positive returns. And before I turn it back over to you, I just want to point out there are still some pockets of opportunity among preferred stocks. A lot of our clients look to preferred as a source of high-quality tax advantage yield, and particularly in the $1,000 par variable rate coupon area where there's duration management potential. So I would highlight the latest edition of the Top Picks report, which will be out today. Our advisors and clients can always access our recommended lists, and of course, we're always available for client calls and consultation here. So our next edition of Top Picks will be out today. Back over to you, Leslie. Thanks.
That's great, Fred. Thanks, and I'll make sure everyone takes a look at that Top Picks report. I mean, you always have some good selections there. But I would just want to just emphasize something that you'd mentioned, which I think is really important, is that when we think about the Fed cuts and what CIO is expecting, which is, you know, for two cuts this year. And what's interesting is that the market is now pricing in three cuts this year and four cuts in 2025. And when we think about some of the short-term volatility that might ensue, as you know, the piece had pointed out, you know, we're not really in clear sailing yet. You know, if the fixed income market is a show-me market, so we do expect a little bit of volatility given the fact that the market is already pricing in close to three for 2024. Again, that's not CIO's expectation, but I think it's a great segue to you, Lena, in terms of high yield, because, you know, we always hear the word bifurcation when it comes to your sector. And we know that, you know, spreads are very tight and yields, although ample, have come down a bit. So how do you view, you know, high yield overall, just in terms of year to date and how they might progress as the cycle starts, continues to mature?
Hi, Leslie. Thanks for having me on, first of all. High yield return so far this year has been pretty good. It has been essentially in line with our expectation for carry-like returns. Year-to-date, high yield total return is 4.2%. If you think about the fact that coming into the year, the yield to worst was around 8%, we are a little more than halfway through the year, and so our total return essentially resembles the carry on the yield that we're getting. So not surprisingly, that most of the return is coming from coupons as opposed to a big rally in prices. Having said that, I do want to point out that spreads have come in a little bit from the beginning of the year, but they have been range-bound for the past several months. And the range has been essentially between 300 basis points and 350 basis points. And we are at 309 right now. So right kind of stuck in this range. I would say that the high yield market has been characterized by three important factors so far this year. First of all, default rates have been very low, and corporate fundamentals remain strong. The default rate is now at 1.9%. This is actually down from 2.4% at the beginning of the year. And the reason the default rates remain contained is that, well, two things really, is that the market has been able to refinance a lot of their maturities, right? There's been a lot of access to the market for high yield companies. And corporate profits have held up okay. So this brings me to the second point, which is that new issuance has been strong this year. Total new issuance is up 77% year over year. And outside of the really low quality companies, most issuers are able to come and refinance their upcoming maturities. We are seeing a lot of companies pull forward and refinance their 2025 and 2026 maturities, and in some cases even refinance some of their 2027 maturities as well. And so thereby, the companies are really improving their liquidity runway going forward. And then finally, the third kind of factor that characterized the high-yield market is that lower quality names, namely the triple Cs, outperformed in the beginning of this year. Triple C's returned 5.1% year to date. Interestingly, triple C spreads really did not tighten very much this year. And most of this performance, once again, is coming from carry. And so it's in line with kind of this trend of carry returns for high yield market. And we think that's likely to continue in the second half of the year. So what do we think going forward? Well, rates played a major role in the outlook during the first half of the year. We think for high yield specifically, it will be less about rates in the second half and more about the economic outlook. If the economy continues its above trend growth, we would expect the high yield market to continue to perform well. We think yields are wide enough that even a carry-like return is an attractive return for the market. However, if the economy slows more than currently expected, then we could see high-yield spread widen. And, of course, the depth of that widening will depend on the depth of the slowdown. And this is not our base case, but this is something to be mindful of in the second half of the year. Now, if we go back to our base case where we see, as you said, Leslie, slower but not slow economic growth, we think high yield should continue to perform. We think corporate fundamentals remain strong. Companies are doing a good job at clearing their runway. So we would expect those themes to continue. And finally, it is important to watch the election and what implications could potential tariffs have on corporate profits. That, you know, of course, depending on what happens, that could have an impact on high yield spreads. So with that said, we remain neutral on high yield. We think yields offer a good carry, but we don't really see spreads going much tighter from here. Let me leave it at that and turn it back over to you, Leslie.
Yeah, that was a great summation, Lena, and I appreciate that. And I think that, you know, just to emphasize some of the points that you made is that, you know, CIO, you know, when we think about our two cuts this year and say 3 to 4 next year, these are what we label as non-recessionary cuts. And we think that this cycle, particularly when you compare it to history, we would label as shallow. So meaning that we think the Fed will have shallow cuts because they're going to be cutting, but in a non-recessionary fashion. There's not going to be a fat tail event. We don't believe in the hard landing. And historically, when you look at sort of these shallow type of cutting cycles, if you will, there haven't been many, maybe only two in the past 40-some years. You know, you see range-bound spreads just slightly wider. But, Barry, I do want to just bring it over to you because, you know, we know that investment-grade corporates are within our preferred allocation. And as Alina just explained, you know, high yield, I mean, right now the spread between high yield and IG is only 216 basis points. That's the fourth percentile over the past 25 years to tell you how well high yield has done. And the yield differential is only 2.5%, which is in the fifth percentile over the past, you know, 25 years. So we're often asked, you know, why are we, you know, have the preferred allocation to investment grade corporates given how well they've done. But if you could just sort of give a synopsis how they've done the first part of the year and how do you think they might perform given this potential shorter runway in the months ahead?
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. So the performance on a total return basis has actually maybe disappointed year to date. We're only up 1.9%. We've had a slight price decline because of the rise in treasuries. But we have had positive excess returns where spreads have tightened by 11 basis points to 93 basis points. So 93 basis points for the investment grade index, that's only the ninth percentile going back over the past 25 years. So we're still in this situation where spreads are tight. But overall yields, now, they're actually up by 9% for the IG index year to date to about 5.24%. And that's still the 65th percentile over the past 25 years. It is the lower end of the range that we've witnessed so far in 2024. We've traded in about a 5.2 to 5.8 yield range. So it seems like it's a little bit low, but again, when you kind of zoom out and think about it from a historical context and even where we started the year, you know, it's still quite attractive. I would make a distinction, though. It's really actually the very long end of the curve that's performed worse this year. So if you just look at more intermediate corporates, 1 to 10-year IG, they've had some slight positive price return added to the income component. So they've had a total return of 2.7%. So it has been, you know, pretty significant relative to the full IG index because of that underperformance in the very long end. You know, our outlook, look, it's very similar to what we've been saying in previous calls where, you know, we do think that it's the yield that's the main value proposition for investors. You know, combined with, again, just our overall macro outlook where we are looking for that soft landing. So, you know, that should support overall issuer fundamentals. We're in a pretty solid, you know, earnings results season. And, you know, we think to the extent that the earnings gains widen out, not just the mega cap tech stocks, that's also positive, you know, for corporate credit fundamentals more broadly. And of course, you know, the fact that we're going to have a Fed easing cycle also should support the overall sector. So overall, you know, again, we've been talking about, if I think, you know, maturity breakdown between, you know, let's say 1 to 3 year and 7 to 10, that's the barbell strategy that we've had. Still think that makes a lot of sense given the slight inversion, even in the investment grade corporate curve. Now it's very slight compared to the treasury curve, but it is still slightly inverted in that 3 to 5 year segment. So that barbell of getting, you know, the attractive income in 1 to 3 plus the additional credit spread offered by 7 to 10, and the 7 to 10 duration component is what could give you some more positive price returns, we think, for the rest of this year. So overall, kind of maintaining that, let's say, intermediate kind of belly of the curve duration positioning, which we think bodes well as, you know, the bond market does actually witness the Fed cutting rates and performance in that belly, you know, duration in that belly, you know, should do well. As it relates to investment grade corporate industry sectors, so the biggest performance trend that we've seen this year has been really the outperformance of financials, the banks, even insurance, and real estate have performed well this year, you know, largely because they had more scope to improve based on the widening that took place last year, and in you know, strong performance for risk assets and IG spreads, you know, we did see that play out. You know, I think that going forward, you know, maybe we're not going to see quite the strong performance that we have seen in the banks from a spread perspective. We consider their valuations to be a bit more fair relative to the IG index, but still consider, you know, large bank bond issues to be core holdings within investment grade corporate bond portfolios for individuals. I think outside of financials, we would take a little bit more of a more of an issuer by issuer approach as opposed to a sector approach. You know, when you think about sectors that have underperformed, I think it's really based on some of the larger issuers within each sector, rather than more broad trends that have impacted the particular industry sector. We think that will continue, where it's more, again, company specific going forward. So we do find opportunities kind of across, when as it relates to non-financials, across different industries, and then as it relates to credit ratings, also across both the main single A rating cohort, you know, which is about half of the IG market, as well as triple B rated issuers. That's another half of the IG market. So, yeah, just to summarize, even though spreads from a valuation perspective are tight, I would do think that additional pickup that you're getting, even over treasuries, you know, and that income carry component over treasuries, when you think about a market weighted coupon for investment grade corporates of about 4.3%, whereas for treasuries, it's only about 3%. So as you mentioned, Leslie, I think that income component will be, you know, a main source of just, you know, investor return going forward that makes us continue to have a most preferred view on the asset class. And I can turn it back to you.
That's great, Barry. Thank you. And again, I mean, it's very, really, you know, accurately and very diligently outlined the reason why that we're still have a most preferred in investment-grade corporates, which we plan on keeping, at least unless we see something in the cycle change. I mean, we know a lot of people compare IG corporates to, say, municipals, and I just want to put on Sadeep on the call. Welcome into the call. Sadeep has to sort of wear two hats, both on the taxable and non-taxable side and the municipal sector. So first off, Sadeep, welcome. And the second thing is that, you know, just to sort of, you know, sum up a little bit with what Barry was leading to. I mean, you know, listen, the taxable REIT side year to date is up as of last night's close, maybe like a 1.2-ish level, but the muni side is lagging a little bit. It's actually lagging the Treasury index a bit as of yesterday's close. It's up positive around 0.6, 0.7, but it is lagging the Bank of America index. But we do, you know, continue like munis. Munis is always a staple in our area. So I just wanted to get your, you know, outlook in terms, or get your take on how the year's progressed and how you see, you know, the last 5 months of the year given the volatility that the market might face.
Sure, and then thanks for having me on, Leslie. Let me just start by giving a very quick performance recap. I think as Leslie pointed out, investment grade munis, tax exempt munis, posted kind of marginal returns year to date. They're off, but only marginally. The real outperformance came from Muni High Yield, which has had a pistoling performance year to date, and that's driven by spread compression. At this point, we really think IG Munis present much better risk-reward trade-offs, at least in the short to medium term. Coming to our preference going forward, we actually like the long end of the curve, the 20 to 30-year high-quality bonds, as the low-rated bonds have had a tremendous spread compression. So long duration, high quality bonds is the way to go according to us against the backdrop of moderating inflation, slower economic growth. It's pretty favorable seasonal technicals. I'll come to that in a bit, and compressed spreads. The curve continues to normalize. The 2-10s have disinverted meaningfully, still slightly inverted, but you know, not that much anymore. The mini treasury ratio, which is the benchmark used by the market for relative value, that actually stands rich at 67 compared to its 10-year average of 87. But the point that we stress is that the long duration tax equivalent yields, is you mean a 40.8% marginal tax rate, the spreads available over treasuries is very attractive. 20-year point at about 126 basis points, 30-year at about 180 to 190 basis points. So that remains very favorable for investors who can take some volatility probably in the intervening period. For long-term buys, this is a very attractive entry point. Technicals, quickly on that, remain very favorable. By technicals, I mean demand and supply. And that despite supply running at a record pace, 39% above the pace last year. And the reason for technicals still to be favorable despite that high supply is the heavy seasonal bond redemptions. June was very heavy. July, August will continue to be heavy. And net supply will remain negative despite the high supply. So some little tailwind from there. Credit quality is very resilient and actually has improved year-to-date on the back of a resilient economy. Upgrades continue to outpace downgrades. Tax revenues all very robust, solid transportation demand. And some sectors such as hospitals and private colleges probably have a little bit of a mixed outlook, but overall credit is very, very resilient. So we have a constructive view on munis. The long-dated yields over spreads over treasuries is attractive. Could be some volatility, as I think Leslie pointed out, slower but not slow economic growth. So the safer sectors, which have underperformed the riskier sectors here today, probably will come back into favor in that environment. But overall, long duration, high quality bonds is the way to go here. Let me turn it back to you, Leslie.
Yeah, thank you, Sudeep. And that really plays into our, you know, higher quality theme with that question, particularly given the fact, as I'd mentioned, the cycle continues to mature. We do expect, you know, weaker but not weak growth, but we also are very cognizant of the fact that the market is already pricing in almost three cuts for 24 and about another four cuts in 2025. And as I mentioned before, fixed income is a show-me market, so we cannot discount the fact that there is, you know, a number that comes above, and, you know, expectation in terms of the inflation, even though we do think the disinflation trend continues, or, you know, a potential of having a month of a falling unemployment rate. So we have to be cognizant of the potential pockets of vulnerability that we see ahead. But we do believe that, you know, we'll have a softer landing, but there's no question that particularly when we look at some of the growth that we saw in the fourth quarter of 2023, growth will slow towards trend. You know, inflation will continue to moderate, not reaching the 2% Fed target, but continue on the path towards that target, like it'll be reaching 2025. So I just want to thank everybody for, you know, coming on to the podcast, and we will be back in September, where we know that our topic of discussion will have more clarity on the November election and potential impacts to our various sectors at that time. Thanks again.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.